Welcome back to Geek Channel 8. I'm Eric.
I'm Rosie.
And I'm Johanna.
This week, we're going to talk about the movie Dracula 2000. What is Dracula 2000? We'll get to that.
If true evil cannot die, is there a chance that it can forever be contained?
Passcode decrypted. Accessing. Security shutting down. Cracked.
For centuries, a secret has been buried beneath the streets of London.
You don't build this kind of security without a gold mine to hide.
Something ageless.
What the hell is that?
The Holy Grail, the Golden Fleece, the Crown Jewels, whatever it is, it's inside.
Something powerful. Something beyond your deepest fears.
What just happened in there?
He is Mephisto.
Who?
Dracula. Not myth. He's real. I assure you.
I don't want to die.
There are worse things than death.
So you haven't told me your name?
We're all so much more complicated than our names.
So this morning, I watched most of and have not finished because I had to like take a break to come record this podcast, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, which only came out a couple years ago. I think we talked about it on the podcast, and I have almost no memory of this thing. I'm like, how has it only been 2 years? And yet the David Lynch Dune and even the sci-fi Dune are more memorable to me than this movie. And I think it's a flaw in the filmmaking, because when I go back and watch it, like I did today, most of it, it's really well crafted. And there's something really extremely well made about it. But it reminds me of like when musicians are really, really talented and they know every note, but they don't have a lot to say. Or a painter knows all the techniques and they can produce a masterful photorealistic painting, but it's not very moving. And that's kind of what I'm getting from this Dune so far. And I'm not to the end. And worse, I'm a little worried that they're going to miss the point of Dune. When I was a kid, I mentioned on this podcast before, I kind of used to get it confused with Star Wars in some ways because I knew what knockoff product was, because there was a ton of knockoff Star Wars stuff. And I would see these paperbacks for Dune when I went in to the comic book store and stuff like that shortly after Star Wars came out. I think the last Dune book came out. And so I'm like, oh, they're just copying Star Wars. But as we all know, Star Wars actually copied Dune, right? So Star Wars ripped off Dune in a lot of ways. But Dune is not Star Wars. Star Wars is not Dune. I'm worried that they're going to try to turn Dune into this sci-fi franchise to compete with Star Wars. And Star Wars, it's very black and white. It is the sci-fi version of Lord of the Rings, right? Dune is like the sci-fi version of Game of Thrones, right? It's like not as morally black and white.
Okay.
And the big thing is you actually have your hero in Dune. He goes to the dark side, right? It's like, I'm worried that they're going to miss this whole idea that Paul is not necessarily going to be, you know, Luke.
Eric, you're putting me in an impossible position because I came today wanting to talk about seeing Dune 2. And now that it's clear you haven't seen it, like,
So my hope, the reason I'm rewatching this, is I'm hoping later today to go out and see Dune 2 because I like the rebels are always the good guys. In this, like, Luke becomes Palpatine, right? That's how Dune should be. Are they going to do that? I'm worried they're not.
Space Hitler. Space Hitler is what I've heard. But yeah, I like Palpatine, another good analogy.
I'm worried that Hollywood is going to Hollywoodize Dune and it's not going to go the way that it should, you know?
Yeah, me too.
I will just say that I was not disappointed with Dune Part 2. I will say, for anyone who hasn't gone out to see Dune 2 yet, it is very, very helpful to try to do it as a double feature. Like, watch Dune 1. Doesn't have to be immediately before, but like the day before. Definitely have that whole world building piece in your head, because Part 2 doesn't have a whole lot of the world building. You kind of have to go in remembering the world that has been built. And that's one of the weaknesses of Part 1, is like there is really no thematic explanation. It's just world building, the whole first part. And it's beautifully executed. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't get to the meat of what the story is. It is in Part 2.
Noted.
So Frank Herbert was alive at the time that the Iranian Revolution happened, you know, and the hostage crisis and all that. And he wrote this book where it's like, if you go in and overthrow this emperor, we'll call him Shaddam, you know, in the desert, you better know what you're replacing him with, you know, because that's something you have to take into account. And here we are, decades later, and Herbert kind of saw the writing on the wall about the Middle East. And I'm just worried that they're going to miss that message, you know?
No, I'd say that Part 2 definitely explains the why this movie, why now question, which you have in watching Part 1. You're like, okay, this is beautiful, but why are you making this movie? And then Part 2, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I see what you're doing here.
So recently, I went back to Cancun with my partner, Rob. We've been going every year since 2018, and even if you have to do a layover, you could still fit in like two movies. If you have a straight flight, you can fit maybe in one and a half. So I decided to finally dive into John Wick. I watched Part 1, Part 2, and most of Part 3, and I think I am going to finish watching it so I can actually talk more about it. But so far, so good. Freaking love it. Keanu Reeves is the love of my life. I love you, Rob, but Keanu Reeves is the love of my life. We've had this conversation. You know, have you ever had that conversation with your partner? Like, you know, if a celebrity that you're in love with ever shows up and says, I want to be with you, and you know what I mean in the biblical sense, would it be allowed? And, you know, of course, it'll never happen. So, of course, you're going to say yes. Yes, it would be allowed. Of course, Rob. Of course you could be with Selma Hayek if she ever presents herself to you and says, I want you. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
Keanu Reeves is mine.
Everybody has that conversation. But what's hilarious is when celebrities have that conversation. I remember seeing one when Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt were together.
Yeah.
Jennifer Aniston chose Steven Tyler from Aerosmith, but said that Brad Pitt was not allowed to have anyone. So apparently it was a one-way thing. Like, she was allowed to, but he was not.
Yeah, we see how well that ended. People are still talking about them. Okay.
I have a correcting the record.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
This was not a fan thing. This is something that I myself meant to say on the podcast last time, but I didn't, and I was reminded of it again when I was editing, so I'm going to do it right now. So this is a correcting the record for the episode on Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Okay.
And I knew at the time I wanted to bring this up, but then it slipped my mind, and we got off onto other things. This is me quoting Johanna interpreting the movie. Quote, Dracula says the partnership with the Catholic Church was not entirely successful. That was the quote. Now, he actually never mentions the Catholic Church, and he would not have. As the story opens in 1462, that was like more than 400 years after the Great Schism between the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Church. So he would have been referring to the Eastern Orthodox Church.
That makes sense to me because there was a lot of Orthodox iconography that I saw, and that was not Catholic. That was Orthodox. So, yep.
By now, all the Catholic fans have written in to say something about this. This is on my mind because today happens to be St. Patrick's Day when we're recording this. But anyway, just wanted to throw that out there.
Fair enough. Apologies all around to the Catholics.
All right. We're going to talk religious stuff today a lot. And the Catholic Church or the Eastern Orthodox might come up in today's film. But before we get into exactly what that is, Rosa, can you give us a background of the year 2000? Y2K.
Y2K. First of all, I just want to mention that at the turn of the year, everybody was flipping the F out because they thought their computers were going to shut down and everything like that because, you know, what was the calendar really built for a 2 in front of the year? And so there was a lot of hype. There were a lot of people saving water in bathtubs and storing food and doing prepper type of things, getting ready for us to roll over into 2000. And of course, nothing happened. We should just spend this segment talking about our funny Y2K stories because we were all there.
Okay, we can do that. But okay, yeah. So mine is, it was New Year's Eve, 1999, and we were all gathered in a living room watching the ball drop in Times Square and all of that. This is like a whole bunch of people in a room, you know, the whole party, like so that everybody knows exactly the moment it happens. Everybody was crowded into this little room and we're watching it on TV, and then 3, 2, 1, and then at 1, TV conks out, all the lights go out.
Oh no.
Everything boom, and we're like, oh shit, it's real, it is on Y2K. What happened was, in the house that we were in, all the lighting was floor lighting and the TV, and it was all plugged into one power cord. And because everybody was crowded in that room, someone had accidentally, my friend, who we now call the Y2K bug, accidentally kicked the power strip out of the wall at that very second, killing the power to everything in the room. And so there was like a few minutes where we thought, oh shit, like the whole grid went down.
You're all over there like, oh God.
It couldn't have been timed more perfectly. Anyway, that's my Y2K story.
My Y2K story was I was involved in going to church and things like that at the time. I had just started dating my ex-husband and we went to a friend's house and brought the New Year in. But before that, the church that I went to was having these Y2K meetings where this guy would come in and be like, you know, I have this water filtration system. It's the best, you know, and he was like, it was totally a sales pitch at the church. And my ex-husband, he went up to him and he's like, okay, let me try that. He worked for a water company, guys. Okay. Totally debunked everything. Debunked everything. Dude was a scam artist. But it was just weird how much people freaked out because I actually knew a couple. Now, keep in mind, the husband was neurotic. I mean, he was neurotic and he was kind of a religious fanatic too. I'm still friends with his ex-wife and his daughter, but, he was just crazy. He claimed he claimed that he brought somebody back to life. Okay. He and his wife were like freaking out about Y2K. They had a bathtub full of water. They did all of the prepper things to like keep a stash of food and water because they honestly thought the world was going to end once it ticked over. It's like, I mean, in the back of my mind, I was like, nothing's really going to happen because surely we have prepared for this. And we had, it was nothing, nothing happened, you know, but everybody, there were so many people that were freaking the fuck out about this.
I lived in a town that was well known in Kentucky among evangelicals as like a place to go at the mm-hmm. end times. I think that the idea of the evangelical mindset about that just sort of fit really well with the whole Y2K thing, which is why I think a lot of churches were like...
Oh, yeah. They were ready for the rapture, okay? They were ready for it to come. They were prepped and ready to go. They had meetings about it. They talked about it a lot. And it, you know, and I went to a church that was more liberal. It was a pastor in jeans kind of, you know, played contemporary, you know, modern day worship type of church. And we still had somebody coming in. They still let somebody come in and have meetings like this. I was kind of surprised.
Johanna, do you have any memories or anything from
Y2K? I was 11. I remember being vaguely aware of it, but, you know, I grew up in a house where we had dial-up internet up until after I left for college. So just like how Y2K was going to affect us personally was pretty limited.
All right, let's hear the production notes for Dracula 2000.
Oh, boy. So, although the official title is Wes Craven Presents Dracula 2000, Wes was only an executive producer and otherwise pretty much uninvolved in the film. Which explains a lot, because I went into this, like, wondering, how is this possible that this film could be so bad with Wes Craven? You know, his stuff is uneven, but not like this.
We saw Wes Craven's version of Dracula. It was Vampire in Brooklyn.
Yeah, which was, yeah, uneven. But, you know, I think he and Eddie Murphy had different ideas of the movie they were making. But I wouldn't say it was bad. It was, you know, just a lot. Anyway, this film, despite Wes Craven's branding on it, is not a Wes Craven movie. While finalizing post-production on Scream 3, Bob Weinstein, Harvey's younger brother, approached an editor, Patrick Lussier, on a modern take on Dracula. All Bob Weinstein had in his head was that it was going to be called Dracula 2000. And when Lussier asked what the film was going to be about, Weinstein was like, I don't know. So Lussier brought on board another collaborator, Joel Soisson, who is best known for producing Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and writing Piranha 3DD, a sequel to Piranha 3D set at an adult water park, which includes a piranha hiding inside a woman's vagina and then biting a guy's dick off.
I did not know this even existed.
Yes. The piranhas eventually are able to walk on land in this film. I did not watch it, but reading about it was enough to understand why Dracula 2000 ended up being the movie that it is.
I might make you guys watch that.
Please don't.
Yeah, we're good.
But in comparison to Piranha 3DD, Dracula 2000 is practically Citizen Kane. So, you know, could be the high point of that guy's career. Anyway, Bob Weinstein thought that the script was terrible, but move forward anyway, because it's called Dracula 2000, and they knew that they were going to sell tickets. During pre-production, they'd already booked a number of the cast members. Christopher Plummer came on board, Jennifer Esposito, Omar Epps, Justine Waddell, Johnny Lee Miller, and they had them rehearsing scenes with assistants, you know, practicing the blocking. And it wasn't until 2 days before filming commenced that they decided to go with Gerard Butler for the lead role of Dracula.
In his first starring role.
Well, yes, it's his first role as a leading man. He'd had a few previous screen roles in Mrs. Brown, which is actually an amazing film, starring Judi Dench as Queen Victoria having a love affair with Billy Connolly, and Gerard Butler plays like Billy Connolly's younger brother or something.
It's a pretty minor role compared to...
Yeah, but it's a great movie, and Gerard Butler was also in Tomorrow Never Dies. But before going into acting, what's kind of fascinating, he's the youngest of three children, son of a bookmaker, although he and his mom left and he hadn't seen his father basically since he was born until he was 16 years old, and his father died when he was 22. So basically fatherless throughout his life. He was the head boy at St. Mirren's and St. Margaret's High School in Paisley, Scotland. And because he was such a good student, he won a place at the University of Glasgow School of Law. He went to law school. He graduated from law school. But because he was always staying out late and drinking, eventually he got fired and could not continue his career in law. And so at the age of 25, with a law degree but completely unqualified to work in the law, he moved to London to pursue his dream of being famous. Not being an actor, being famous.
Okay.
And initially, he wasn't able to win any acting roles. He worked in a variety of jobs, including as a waiter, telemarketer, a toy demonstrator at fairs. And eventually, he ran into an old friend from his teenage days who got him an audition for Coriolanus. He got a part in the ensemble, and then eventually his acting career took off. Dracula 2000, as we mentioned, was his first role as a leading man. And when he was interviewed about the film, he was asked, "How much input did you have in creating this cool new Dracula?" And Gerard Butler said, "Not an awful lot. I had a lot of ideas about the way I wanted to look, but pretty much none of them happened. I mean, there were 12 guys making the decisions for me." When asked, "Why was your dialogue always so sparse?" Gerard Butler said, "Well, it wasn't always so sparse. I guess I didn't do very well because they cut a lot of it out. It was like," and then he adopts an American accent, "No, no, we want a cool effect. He doesn't have to talk." But I suspect it's because at this time, Gerard Butler had not yet perfected his American accent and no one was going to buy a Scottish Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
I looked to try to find information about what exactly inspired his interpretation of Dracula, but as far as I could find, he was just like, "Yeah, he's like sexy and cool like me, and this is going to be an easy role." And that's as far as his inspiration went for the character. So, given that, I think it explains a little bit about the film that we ended up with, and I have further comments, but I will save them for when we dig into the film.
Well, if that's the case, I think we should dig into the film. I could tell from your intro that you weren't too impressed with this film. I will say that I happen to have a soft spot for the polished dimension horror films of the late 90s, early 2000s, which is what a lot of people call the glamour lighting horror films, which this one is.
Totally.
Okay, so I should have made a confession in my intro. I had seen this movie before as a teenage girl because I saw Gerard Butler in Phantom of the Opera, which I actually think is one of his best performances. But it led me down a whole rabbit hole of then having to see every Gerard Butler film for a while. And this was one of them. And at the time, I was like, "Oh my gosh, he's so sexy in this movie." And then revisiting it, I actually was like 30 minutes in before realizing, like, "Wait a minute, this is Gerard Butler. I've seen this movie. God damn it." And it's like his hair is so bad in this movie. It's like Chris Sarandon from Princess Bride bad. And just like some of the choices in this film.
The big question here is, did you see this before or after having seen Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Oh, definitely after. And yeah, I mean, this was not any competition with Scary Gary.
Everyone!
No, of course not. It's not.
No.
In any way, shape, or form. But I just wanted to say that out there because I don't totally hate this film. I don't think it's great. I wouldn't rank it very highly, but I don't hate it. And there's some things it does that I actually kind of think are kind of cool. But we'll get to that. The movie opens, we get about 10 seconds of Victorian London before it immediately switches to the 2000s London. Carfax Abbey is now Carfax Antiquities.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Plummer plays Van Helsing and he runs this place. And it more or less moves quickly into a heist film. It's an inside job. I think Selena is the character's name.
Yes. Jennifer Esposito.
Jennifer Esposito. By the way, some of these people went on, like Gerard Butler, to great fame. a lot of these people didn't. Like, I'm kind of like, I remember that person had a moment back in the early 2000s. What happened to them? I felt that way about a lot of the people in this film.
Mm-hmm. Except Johnny Lee Miller, who actually is a real actor. And one of my favorite things that Johnny Lee Miller is in is a stage version of Frankenstein, where he and Benedict Cumberbatch traded the roles every other night, where one of them was the monster and one of them was Dr. Frankenstein. Amazing.
I just saw a fun fact about him. Johnny Lee Miller vomited on the first day of filming Trainspotting. I just thought that was funny. Okay, moving on.
Van Helsing, he acquires antiquities, which he then admits he is somewhat dealing in illegal antiquities. There's this vault where he keeps some stuff, and Jennifer Esposito's character, Selena, teams up with some people to raid this vault. And it's got one of the really cool transitions in it where they use a fake eye to do a retina scan, and then it transitions to the vault opening, the inside of the vault, which I just thought was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
They find this vault has some weird stuff like vampire skulls, which, by the way, don't all have the teeth in the same place on them, but it was somewhat reminiscent of the opening scenes from the 1979 Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing really of value, except there's this coffin, this metal coffin that they can't figure out how to open. So they straight up decide that they're going to steal this coffin and figure out how to get it open later. And so they do. And they take it aboard a plane bound for New Orleans. So that's where things are going to move to very quickly. What's interesting about this is I was in New Orleans in 2000. And so I remember New Orleans in 2000. At the beginning, I tell they're using like sound stages and stuff like that. Like, it's not actually the French Quarter. But later on, there's a couple of shots that I'm like, okay, they got some footage actually in New Orleans, but very little. I don't know. I didn't look up the shooting locations, but it looked like they maybe used some B-roll from New Orleans.
Yeah, and from watching some behind-the-scenes videos, a lot of it was done on sound stages.
Who made the original connection between vampires and New Orleans? Where did that come from? Because I've seen it over and over and over and over and over again. Was that... And forgive me, because I didn't know... I never read the original, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Is that mentioned in the book, or is it only mentioned in, like, Anne Rice films?
Anne Rice definitely took it to the top. She was a New Orleans resident and threw big vampire parties there every year.
Mm-hmm.
In the goth scene, it was legendary. But I think it's just that New Orleans had such a long, sort of spooky, old world history. Its ties to, well, Orleans, like, so French, you know, both France and Spain.
Right.
It's always sort of been there on the surface. I don't know what the very first connection between New Orleans and vampires was. It probably predates Anne Rice, but I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. She's definitely the one that put it on the map, though. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my guess would be that it's one of the few places in the United States that still feels old. Mm-hmm. Like, there are parts of New York City that are old, but so much of it has been built up that it no longer has any sense of what its character would have been in the 19th century. And I think ultimately, vampires and the Victorian era are still very, very closely tied together, even when you adapt them to the modern age.
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans is one of the few towns where you kind of get some of that 19th century feeling.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that evokes different cultures and not the Civil War. Like, if you were to set this in Charleston, like, a lot of that also still feels like an old city, but it's like very much like slave markets, and it's hard to escape that part of the history. Whereas in New Orleans, there's so much else going on.
Okay, that makes sense.
New Orleans has an occult connection to witches, to voodoo, to all these other things also. So it's just like vampires comes along for the ride in some ways, you know?
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. It just makes sense.
It was one of the few things about this film that I thought was a good choice. Like, I was like, okay, like, yeah, vampires in New Orleans, like, this could be fun. Let's go there.
Right. I feel like it's the one place they could actually be kind of a chameleon in and get by with it.
Yes.
That and maybe New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brooklyn. We've been there.
Yeah.
Right.
One thing that's really interesting here is Van Helsing's like shooting up, and it's not like a Dr. Seward shooting up heroin kind of thing. He's shooting up leech juice in this.
Yes. I have in my notes, leeches, gross.
Yeah, leeches are definitely gross. That icked me out.
It makes sense later on in the film.
True.
They just don't tell you in the beginning. I was just like, what the hell? Why is he shooting up leech juice?
Truly, he's a mad scientist. Yes.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in New Orleans, unrelated to these coffin-stealing people, there's Mary, who is basically the Mina of this show. She has no man in her life.
We first see her wearing a Virgin Media t-shirt.
We're going to have to talk about that. So she's wearing a shirt that says Virgin on it really big.
And her name's Mary.
And her name is Mary. I mean... And her name is Mary. So there's that. She also goes to church, and we see a pre-Firefly Nathan Fillion as the priest.
Yes. Yep.
There's another person that came up. They finally get the coffin open and Dracula's in it, covered with leeches. And now we know why the leeches are in the story. Basically, Christopher Plummer's character is the original Van Helsing from the Victorian period, who has kept himself alive by injecting Dracula's blood into himself, which he harvests via leeches. Dracula escapes on this plane and kills everybody on board, and it crashes into the swamp. So basically, the plane in this is the Demeter.
Yes.
Which is really kind of clever.
Mm-hmm.
Reporting on this plane crash, Jerry Ryan, one of the few good things from Star Trek Voyager, or a couple of the good things from Star Trek Voyager, she is the reporter. This has one of the scenes I really like because, again, this movie hits a lot of my buttons that makes me like it more than I otherwise would. The cameraman doesn't see her getting attacked. She is attacked by Dracula on camera, but he's looking through his camera. So he just sees this happening. Those who don't know, camcorders use a mirror to show you what they're recording. So since vampires cast no reflection in a mirror, he doesn't see Dracula. He only sees her and something's happening to her. And then he drops the camcorder and sees what's going on. I thought that was super clever.
Yes, very.
It was that. Okay, that I admit in terms of the modern adaptation, nailed it. That was so cool.
Can we talk about the fact that Danny Masterson got killed by Dracula first because he was the one who opened the coffin and he's like, and I can't stand him now. And I used to like him because he was on That 70s Show.
Okay.
I'm just saying. It was a little gratifying.
All right.
I had to throw that in there.
That's fine.
You know, he's in jail now.
The gist of it is Dracula is now free and goes from vampire form to more human looking form as the long haired hunk Gerard Butler.
I disagree with the hair choice in this film. If you look at his audition tapes, he actually auditions with like quite a lot longer of a wig, which I think would have worked better. But it had this like floofy 90s thing going on that was really horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to do a better or worse at the end of this, but I'm just going to jump in right here. Better or worse, Gerard Butler's hair in this or the wig that Eddie Murphy thought sunk Vampire in Brooklyn? Who had the better hair?
I'm going to go with Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy had the better hair.
We're going to go with the vamp mullet. Yep.
Yep.
Really? The hair that supposedly made that movie flop is better than...
Yeah, and less comical somehow.
Somehow. And it was a mullet.
Speaking of Vampire in Brooklyn, we get the same deal here. Mary's having nightmares about what's going on. She has a roommate. That roommate's name is Lucy. And of course, if you're Dracula, where do you find a virgin in New Orleans? The Virgin Megastore.
Of course.
Perfect.
I don't know how much Richard Branson paid for this, but this has like virgin crap all over it. So there's a scene where he goes to the Virgin Megastore and meets Lucy Westenra, who works there. Of course, is blonde, because like I've said in the past, we flipped it in the modern age. And so, you know, you get the pure, innocent Virgin Mary is brown haired, and Lucy, the, you know, I don't know what you call it.
I think
it.
Her the, name's Lucy, but they all call, we'll her, call her Luce.
Yeah, has blonde hair. The I'm trying to think of a non-slut-shaming way of saying this. The promiscuous.
She was very sexually free. She was sexually free.
Yes.
She was free from the binds of religious puritanistic ideology. There you go.
Thank you.
And she was played by Vitamin C, pop star, who was popular back then.
Oh, I forgot about Vitamin C.
Yep. Lucy Westerman was played by Vitamin C.
Vitamin C's not on the soundtrack, but this had a pretty good metal soundtrack with some industrial and thrash thrown in there. So it had Power Man 5000, Static X, Godhead with Marilyn Manson, Slayer, System of a Down, Monster Magnet, who I really like. They're the ones playing when he arrives at the Virgin Megastore, Disturbed, Pantera, etc. So this is like when nu metal was new, before nu metal became really lame. So like, this is just the birth of that genre. It's kind of cool. I couldn't listen to it all day long. I definitely think that there's a lot of better metal. And just to make us all feel old, since I said nu metal was new, I love this meme that I've seen going around the internet the last couple of years where like nu metal is now older than original metal was when nu metal was new. So think about that for a minute.
I don't want to. I feel old now.
When he meets Lucy at the store, he goes home with her. She asks his name. He has this line where he says, "Names, I have many."
Mm-hmm.
That is some foreshadowing. She offers, you know, him to come in, and he comes in, and she offers him coffee. And he says,
"Hey, can I get you some coffee or something?"
"I don't drink coffee."
Coffee. So it is time for that part of the show. This movie is so 90s, even though it came out in 2000. It was the last year of the 20th century. Yes, 2000 is part of the 20th, not the 21st century. So, of course, I chose coffee to drink watching this. Now, this was before the coffee bubble of the 90s burst in 2021. But there was this big bubble, and then there was a crash of the coffee market in 2021. I'm not going to get into all that here. And while I believe that wine tasting is bullshit, like I've said before, I was a barista like everybody else in the 90s. And so I believe there is something to coffee tasting. I'm not going to go into brand names or anything like that. I'm not going to do a deep dive into coffee history or anything like that right now, but I'm just going to tell you what I had and what I paired with this movie. I started with some beans, whole beans, Arabica, not Robusta. And if you want good coffee, I always recommend Arabica. I used fair trade coffee beans, ground them myself. I prefer a fine grind. You can do a coarse grind, a medium grind, or a fine grind. I do a fine grind, which is like powdered sugar. It's very, very fine.
Mm-hmm.
I have every coffee making device you can think of. I have the dripolator. I have the percolator. I have the Turkish coffee pot. I have the pour over ceramic cones. My favorite way to make coffee is the French press. You know, some coffee purists just, I drink it straight. I don't think that's the way to drink coffee. Espresso, yes, but coffee in general, different kinds of coffee have different levels of bitterness. And you have to find just the right balance with that bitterness. And the sweetener I prefer is actually regular cane sugar. And different kinds of coffee have different levels of acidity. And the way to balance that is with some sort of dairy product. I like whole milk. And usually it's just a little bit. People over-sweeten and over-cream their coffees. You need to find just the right amount for the coffee that you're doing. And you're not going to know that on the first cup. Once you get to know your beans and know your grind and all of that, you can find what that balance is. But it's kind of like a titration kind of method. Like you're slowly learning how to do it. And I know the perfect balance for mine. Or certain times, like today, again, I mentioned earlier, St. Patrick's Day, I used Irish cream, which has both the cream and the sugar in it to sweeten it. But then again, you need to find what the right amount of Irish cream is for your coffee. So that's what I had. That's what I paired with this movie. And I think coffee is what you do.
If I may suggest an inspiration based on the coffee line, because this is based in New Orleans, maybe Café du Monde's chicory coffee.
Ooh.
It's not as good as real coffee, but just for the flavor.
I'll take that. I was trying to avoid any product placement, but yeah, chicory coffee is it's made from chicory root. It's a coffee substitute. Café du Monde, beignets and coffee is a thing. Okay, so let's get back into Dracula 2000. Dimension gets super self-referential with Lucy's call to Mary right after this, which is a direct Scream reenactment.
Mm-hmm.
The camera angle, the where are you? Where do you think I am? You know, that whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Did you guys pick up on that at the time you were watching it?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen the Scream movies, I confess. But it makes sense that, you know, given that they were just coming off of those projects. I don't know. Like, it just doesn't seem like it's for me. But maybe you can convince me otherwise.
I watched the first Scream and I got pissed off when they pushed that Drew Barrymore was in the movie and then she was killed within the first scene. I was done with the Scream movies after that. I was like, y'all pissed me off. I don't care what it's about anymore.
That's a horror movie tradition. Like that goes back to Psycho, right? Where they cast the big star and then the big star is killed in the first few minutes. Like that is especially a slasher film trope.
I wasn't aware of that, but either way, it pissed me off. And after that, I was like, yeah, this is corny. I don't like it.
I think you're wrong. I think Scream is great. I don't think Johanna would like it as much because it relies on nostalgia of 80s slasher films. But we'll get into that another time. I got a question for you guys. Did you notice that there were fire extinguishers in a lot of scenes?
No.
No.
In the background of a whole lot of shots, in different locations at different points in the movie, you see fire extinguishers. And I'm not sure if they were trying to like foreshadow something. There is a fire thing that happens toward the end or what, but I thought it was kind of odd that you saw fire extinguishers so often in this. And I didn't know if like they were trying to make a statement there.
Keen observation there, Eric. I would have never even noticed. I obviously never noticed that. So good eye.
This is the most overtly religious version of the Dracula story that we've had since Bram Stoker's Dracula. This is what I like about this movie. Bram Stoker, he took inspiration from Dracula from Vlad Tepes, as we all know, Vlad the Impaler. And the movie Bram Stoker's Dracula took that and made him the actual Dracula. So it gave us an origin story for Dracula and it took us back to the 15th century and had Vlad, this Christian soldier, whatever, fighting the Ottoman Turks and all that. And ever since then, now everybody just assumes that is the backstory to Dracula, but it was just invented by that film, inspired by the character that inspired Stoker. But Stoker never suggests that Vlad Tepes is Dracula. This movie gives us another possible origin story, and a pretty clever one, in my opinion. They go through all this thing about his hatred for Christianity, which both of those movies have, but they bring up why silver? So in this, the silver bullet thing applies to vampires as it does with werewolves. Why silver? It's not uniquely Christian is a direct quote from this. And then we get to the reveal.
Yeah, which is actually, I agree with you. This is a cool, interesting interpretation. Are we allowed to spoil it for our audiences?
Go for it.
Dracula is actually Judas Iscariot. And
yes,
the whole, like, you know, blood is the life thing. Like, the reason why vampires insist on the blood is tying back to some of that other Christian mythology in a cool new way. And then they've added these other tie-ins with the silver.
Here's where I think this origin story is even cooler than the Bram Stoker's Dracula origin story, just based on the story, which is that in Bram Stoker's Dracula, he stabs the cross and he turns against Christ and stuff like that. And then he's cursed and damned and all of that for stabbing a cross in a church with a sword.
Mm-hmm.
In this, we have the real story of, or the real, we have the biblical story of Judas Iscariot, who was paid silver for betraying Christ, right? So there right. is where the silver ties in. The thing about the Judas story is, it was preordained. He was maligned, cursed, and condemned by God for something that had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
His role, if you believe in Christian mythology, I'll call it, or cosmology or whatever, that had to happen in order for humanity to be saved. So he has become this scapegoat that can't go to hell, can't go to heaven, like damned to walk the earth. So if you were that guy, you would really hate God, right? Like, this is worse than right. Job, right? You are like, anyway, I was not raised in the faith like you guys were. So you might have a different opinion mm-hmm. about it. But when I'm looking
Wait,
at this.
Whoa. I was raised Unitarian Universalist. I am so far out of the faith. My understanding of Christianity is just from John Milton's Paradise Lost. That's the best explanation I've gotten, but I have not read any of the Bible, so don't lump me in with those believers.
Yeah, you'll have to loop me in with them, because I was raised in a conservative Christian home, and so to be honest with you, when I saw the link, when I saw them make the connection, like, you know, Dracula was actually Judas Iscariot, I was like, that kind of makes sense. That kind of makes sense to me, you know, with everything that I grew up with everything that I was taught, with what it says in the Bible, it makes sense. Like, you know, they took his suicide attempt and then, you know, flipped the script on it. And now he's Dracula. And the way they made the connections, I was like, okay, yeah, I could see where they could make this connection and present this as an origin story for Dracula.
The interesting thing about it is how he says that he's the savior, and in a way he is, because if Judas Iscariot chose not to betray Christ, right,
mm-hmm.
then Christ is never crucified, never raises from the grave. None of that happens, right? And humanity is not saved. So had he chosen not to do this, all of humanity is not saved. He becomes the scapegoat for all of humanity, right? Anyway, I think it was very clever of them to come up with this. Now, the movie was not good overall, but you can see the foundation of something good that was there, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, the movie definitely could have been better. It had the potential to be better, but it just wasn't.
I'm just going to put in a plug here that if you find this stuff about free will and God's role in deciding what should or shouldn't happen or allowing evil to exist, like, you got to read John Milton's Paradise Lost. There's a whole book in this epic poem where God is talking to an angel, basically explaining this whole plan, where the angel is like, but why did you let Satan be Satan in the first place? Like, you could have stopped that. And God's basically like, but that's not my plan. Like, I have this plan. Let me tell you about the whole plan. And then sort of lays out this arc of, you know, needing to allow humanity to be tempted because it would be no fun if he just made us do whatever he wanted us to do. Like, where's the fun in that? So it's, yeah, anyway, it gets really in the weeds on this. Highly recommend.
Final thoughts about Dracula 2000. I'll go first. I find it to be a charming B movie. I find it to be a film that I have seen it before once. I'll probably never watch it again, but I did enjoy watching it a second time. I think that it is very, I like it for like a popcorn B kind of movie. And admittedly, it has a lot of things in it that just connect with me. It was this moment in time, like I was right on the cusp of my 30s. The music, everything sort of connects with me in a way that I could easily see another movie of the same quality and different actors and different music and stuff like that not connecting with me. It's just like, it just hits all the right notes for me to like it more than to dislike it.
I agree that, like, it's not, for me, it's not as simple as liking it or not liking it. I think on reflection, I wish it were just a little bit campier. And from listening to interviews, they were deliberately resisting camp. They were trying not to let that happen. And I think that was the wrong impulse.
Because that was a mistake.
So there's so much here that if they just leaned in a little bit further, this would be a very memorable vampire movie. It would be a fun, like, oh, we got to rewatch that kind of thing. And instead, it's just like, as you said, like, it's a fine B movie. Other folks have said, you know, like, there's no point in making another Dracula movie unless you have something new to say with it. I do feel like this film has something new to say with the Judas Iscariot angle. It is a different twist on the Dracula story. I also think that some of the touches, like the brides, excellently done. Like, great, great execution on the Brides of Dracula concept. Being able to see them created, for instance, is actually really cool. And they all looked really sexy in their white getups when, you know, they're attacking Johnny Lee Miller. So there are parts of this that were well done and interesting, and I just wish they'd leaned into it more.
One other little clever little thing that they did in here was the way that Van Helsing originally trapped Dracula. So Van Helsing decides that Dracula cannot actually be killed, he can only be contained, and he traps him by using mirrors to his advantage. So you can't see Dracula in a mirror. Dracula cannot see himself in a mirror, so he was able to lure him into a trap by using a mirror, and so he was seeing his reflection, but he was actually standing behind him, not in front of him. Dracula could see Van Helsing's reflection, but not his own, which would be blocking if you were standing in front of somebody else. I thought it was really a cool way of trapping Dracula.
Yes, I will say, of all of the Draculas we've seen, this one makes the most of the vampires have no reflection idea. Did the most creative things with it, and in the least, like, you know, I'm going to look at this cigarette case, you know, 8 times in order to hammer home the, like, look, he doesn't have a reflection thing. Like, it was just at the right level.
I was a little confused that he could actually be killed, but then I saw that there are actually sequels to this film, so obviously he wasn't fully killed, I guess. But it was just interesting, you know, how I like the scene where she killed him. I thought that was an interesting take on how to eliminate somebody that supposedly can't be eliminated. Interesting choice in some of the characters, like I had mentioned, Danny Masterson, who I don't remember seeing him in much of anything outside of that 70s show, and obviously for good reason, given the fact that he's in prison now for rape. Also, I wanted to mention Lachlan Monroe. He's been in a lot of things. As a matter of fact, he played Betty's father in Riverdale most recently. I've seen him in so many bit parts in so many films, so it was kind of neat to see him in that. I'm like, oh, it's him, he always plays a jerk. Yep, he's a jerk again. But I mean, all in all, it was entertaining. I even kind of feel like I saw kind of a Hellraiser inspiration to that, like with the chessboard. Remember the chessboard in the beginning where you press the button and it came up? It kind of reminded me of the box. But I mean, it was a fun film. It was campy, but definitely could have been campier, you know, so that it was more like believable to me, because it was very much, you know, like you said, a kind of a 90s glam horror film. But it was interesting to see some of these actors in here that, you know, you could tell like this is kind of where they started out. And would I watch the movie again? Probably not, but I'm glad that I did. It was entertaining. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, let us know your thoughts. Did you like or hate Dracula 2000? You can write us at GC8 Podcast. That's letter G, letter C, number 8, podcast@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Eric.
This is Rosie.
This is Johanna.
Signing off. I don't know how much Richard Branson paid for this, but this has like virgin crap all over it.